All right, so I'm going to actually talk about a lot today, and most of it is going to be wrong. Have you ever heard someone actually introduce their talk that way? This talk basically is about an attempt to be a theorist, which is to connect coincidences and see what you get out of it, and see if those attempts are consistent by the standards of what we call theoretical physics, and of course, observations. So today is we're going to take an adventure into the land of trying to tie in two coincidences, which is late time acceleration and neutrino oscillations. This has been an attempt so far by three groups of people. It really started by a seminal paper by Neil Weiner and Nelson and Fardon. I forget his first name. Yes, that's right. Thank you. Did the recording get Niyash's? Okay. And of course, Niyash kind of killed that model. We'll talk about that in a few years. It took a few years to kill the model, but then I came back on the scene. Okay. And also, there was also another group by Ma and Bhatt and Sarkar, and then of course I know that Rob did some follow-up work, which relates neutrino oscillations to dark energy. What I'm going to talk about is slightly different, but the sort of motivation, philosophy, it takes the following orientation, which is that we have lots of dark energy models on the scene. And what I mean by dark energy model, I mean I'm setting, there's some unknown mechanism that sets lambda to zero. Okay? You don't like that, but... and so there's some unknown model, mechanism that sets lambda to cosmological constant to zero, and then we're left to ask, well, what do we need to account for this late-time acceleration? Maybe we could invoke Niyash's model, which I like very much, and maybe this is related to that model. So usually there are two things one has to do if you believe that dark energy is a thing, okay, that's accounting for the late-time acceleration. There are two things, usually, if you believe in Occam's razor. You usually, whatever this dark energy model is, usually you have to introduce a new degree of freedom. Or at least one degree of freedom, but usually, in a lot of cases, many degrees of freedom. And that also include models of modified gravity, because if you introduce higher order derivatives, you introduce more degrees of freedom for your metric. Or, if you introduce this new degree of freedom, you usually have to introduce new physics. Okay? And I don't want to go into all the new types of physics, exotic physics that one has to introduce. So my philosophy, I will be very clear about what my philosophy is and how it fits into this context here. But before I do that, let me just give you an outline. But I'll just, of course, present the big picture. I'll tell most of you, we're all cosmologists, most of us, so we kind of know what the big picture is. So I don't want to spend too much time on convincing you that dark energy is real, because the Nobel Prize was given earlier on this year for that. And then what I will do is review neutrino oscillations from the standard model. So I want to definitely do that. And I will talk about two models. So in other words, I'm agnostic too. I'm going to provide for you two models, okay, where the physics is the same physics though. So it's going to be the same physics, and that physics is known, okay? We use this physics all the time, and I will give you examples of that. And then I will talk about some possible predictions. So going back to my philosophy, so I'm going to present two models of dark energy if there's time. So I'm going to rush through, unfortunately, certain details, but you can find it in the papers. But the thing, I'm going to have to introduce new degrees of freedom. But the way the new degrees of freedom are actually are going to enter this model has to do with the standard model. It's going to have to do with a logical extension and a minimal extension of the standard model. So this new degree of freedom that I'm introducing, in both cases, have to do with the minimal extension to the standard model. And I'm not talking here about the supersymmetric standard model. I'm just talking about the good old standard model that we have tested, okay? So the way the new degree of freedom is going to come about is not going to be ad hoc. It's going to have to do with the standard model. And the physics that we're going to invoke here are going to be dynamical physical mechanisms that we know exists, okay? And that mechanism is called a Nambu-Joyner-Lessigno model. This is what Nambu won a Nobel Prize for. This is a mechanism that underlies chiral symmetry breaking. Okay, so that's basically the philosophy. So the first thing I want to talk about is the possibility that if you do such a thing, okay, so if you do such a thing, then there's a natural sort of thing that, not thing, but there's a natural type of physics that suggests itself when you do these types of dark energy model. And that has to do with neutrino oscillations. I'm not claiming that we get neutrino oscillations. There's a lot of technical work that needs to still be done, okay, to really, but the minute you start writing down relevant operators, you start seeing the structure of neutrino oscillations come out of this for free, okay? Well, nothing is for free. One time I tried to hop the bus when I was in third grade, and the bus driver said, "Son, nothing is for free. Get out." It's but he took me back in. It's a bad joke. It wasn't for free. So I had to, like, you know, come back in and apologize, and was interested. Okay. So what do we know about neutrinos in the standard model? What I mean by the standard model, I mean the massless minimal standard model, where, first of all, the old-fashioned standard model, where neutrinos are purely chiral, meaning that they were only left-handed. Because they were only left-handed, okay, so in this thing, there's no coupling, there are no Dirac coupling of the Higgs to these neutrinos. This was before we discovered that neutrinos, quote-unquote, had masses, okay? And if that's the case, the theory is decomposing into two sectors where the neutrinos interact only via the chiral weak interaction. You have a left-handed and a right-handed helicity of neutrino states. And there were three known flavors of neutrinos. Of course, the partners, the isospin partner of the electron, the muon, the tau leptons, we have the associated neutrinos. And because they're all left-handed, they had no coupling to the Higgs field. So that's sort of like the old standard model until Super Kamiokande made observations of neutrino oscillations. So how did that happen? Why do we believe that that has to do with neutrino masses? So the best way to understand this is to take two neutrino states, for example. Let's take a muon neutrino and an electron neutrino, okay? And I want you to think of a two-state quantum system. If I have a two-state quantum system as such, two energy eigenstate, so here is E2 and here is E1, okay? And I write down a time-dependent psi1 plus psi2. So these are energy eigenstates. I could always talk about a time-dependent evolution of these two energy eigenstates. And what I will get, basically, the time development of that mixed state will always have an energy dependence. Here it is, E1 and E2, where these states will oscillate back and forth. It's just a solution of the Schrodinger equation, if the energies are different. Now, neutrinos, if they're nearly, they obey this dispersion, if they have mass. And therefore, the energy, I can expand that in a relativistic approximation as P plus m squared over 2p. So you see that a muon neutrino, okay, expanded in terms of two flavor eigenbases. This is what I call, the mass eigenbasis. Okay, this is the energy eigenbasis. What you will find that if I want to now compute the probability of a muon neutrino to go into an electron neutrino, I just take the overlap between these two states, okay, and the flavor eigenbasis. So this is a mass eigenbasis, and I go into the flavor eigenbasis. This is the basis that the W boson interacts with the muon neutrinos. So I can induce transitions from one state to the other by a weak transition through the W boson, for example, or the Z. So if I take this expectation value, I basically get this formula, just plug this in, I get sine squared 2 theta, and I get another oscillation that depends on the mass, on the change, the differences in the mass. And so by measuring this oscillation, and that's exactly what one measures, you can measure this phase, and you will get basically that for a solar neutrino, okay, that travels at this distance, well, 620 miles from the atmosphere, that this delta M is 10 to the minus 3 electron volts. Okay, so how does this all happen in detail now? So now that was just a toy model. So if we go to the standard model vertex, a weak vertex between the neutrinos and leptons, for example, okay, and this in this basis we can rotate, okay, into a flavor basis by a unitary transformation. This is the unitary transformation. This is the mass matrix, the CKM mass matrix. So I can rotate from this mass basis, the one that I had up here, okay, into a flavor basis by applying this unitary transformation. I get these mixin matrices. Okay, so that's a matrix that encodes the mixin, and this is the thing that we could measure when we look for CP violation, for example, what we call theta 1-3. This is just the 1-3 component of the 3-by-3 matrix. So far, so good? Or am I moving too quickly? This is stuff that many of us saw in first year graduate school. So that's neutrino oscillation. And the important thing to take away with you there is that this delta M is 10 to the minus 3 electron volts. This is the difference in the mass eigenstates of a muon neutrino and an electron neutrino. And this has been measured independently now. So that's the thing I want us to take away. Why is that the case? So why that is the case is very unnatural in the standard model. The minute you say that neutrinos have mass, that means you have to introduce the Higgs coupling again. So now we have a Higgs field, okay? And by naturalness arguments, this coupling will give these neutrinos lepton-sized masses, masses comparable to that of the electron. But, okay? That's not the case, though. We see that neutrinos are, you know, 10 to the minus 3 electron volts rather than, you know, 100 electron volts. Okay, so why this huge hierarchy? So what you have to do is, you know, one game you can play is to say, well, there was some other grand unified theory with another Higgs-like mechanism, and I can generate a heavier neutrino. I introduce another neutrino that's purely right-handed, for example, and through some unknown physics, you know, this thing gets a heavy mass, and when I include that mass, okay, with the Dirac masses now, okay, and I diagonalize that thing, that large mass suppresses the mass that the Higgs endowed the neutrinos with. That's called a seesaw mechanism. So that's, so far, that's the best mechanism known. And most models of neutrino masses are some flavor of that basic idea. You introduce a very heavy massive thing, and that takes the mass down, okay? I don't want to spend too much time on that. Well, everyone knows by now this cleaned up plot, you know, it's now it's a cartoon, but we know that the universe is accelerating. But the important thing there, this is the famous cartoon version, okay, of what won the Nobel Prize this year. And the other piece of evidence that we should be living in a world where most of the energy, okay, is dark, has to do with the location of this first peak. It's very hard to get rid of it. I tried to get rid of it years ago by trying to confront the WMAP data with void models, and it didn't work, basically. You have to do really funky things. All right. So we know that there's something like dark energy. It's a dark component that's causing the universe to accelerate. So you can do two things. Well, the two famous things that one can do. My colleague at Dartmouth, Rob Caldwell, doesn't like me to say this, but I'll say it anyway, since he's not here. So you can either add a cosmological constant, and you're done, right? Except you have to figure out why such, right? You have to become really smart and solve a measure problem, okay? Or you can do this game where you added some fundamental scalar field whose potential is on the order of milli electron volts today. But then you have to tell me why quantum corrections don't spoil that, and or come up with some systematic way of dealing with that issue. And they, of course, require horrendous fine-tuning. I am not going to tell you that my model or our model doesn't require fine-tuning, okay? It's just as bad. However, we have a new window, a new set of tools where we can really analyze questions of stability, because we're actually dealing with quantum mechanical phenomena in these types of model. So we're going to assume that the cosmological constant is zero and try to beef up this quintessence type idea. Okay? So this is a friend of mine. I don't remember if you remember Kamran. So Kamran is one of my best friends. We were all grad school together, like, 15 years ago or something like that, until he left us for greener pastures. So Kamran was the top student in my class. He was brilliant, was a string theorist, all this stuff. Decided he wanted to become a neuroscientist because he was so hard on himself and so doubtful of his own abilities that so everything he did was wrong, including today. Even though he's a successful neuroscientist, he's now a professor at Wisconsin and just had a kid this year. But so he's always a skeptic, and we used to always argue all the time, even up till today. So he's a skeptic. So there's a coincidence that the scale of dark energy today is this number, and the scale of atmospheric oscillations is that number. So Cameron will tell me, and he did tell me, there are lots of coincidences in nature. So why are you trying to go after this one? Okay. And then there's a dreamer. That's me here. And so you got nothing better to do your time, so cook up a model that might have a prediction. That's the dream. Of course, the dream is not realized. All right. So the first model I want to talk about is a sterile neutrino condensate. Before I go into this model, let me back up and say a few words about what I mean by a condensate. What I mean by a condensate is a phase-coherent many-body quantum mechanical system. In this case, that's made up of fermions, like a BCS condensate. These are bound states. These are not propagating particle states. So when we think all of our intuitions about, for example, neutrinos in the relic neutrino background, this will be a relic neutrino background that is a bound state, okay, as opposed to the usual Boltzmann treatment you do for particle states. So we have propagating states in particle physics. These are momentum eigenstates, usually, smeared out momentum eigenstates. Or we have bound states. In this case, these are bound states. Okay, so they have net zero momentum. So that's the first thing I want to, you know, sort of get our mind around, that we're talking about something different, a new ingredient that we're adding into the cosmology, into the soup. So the model I'm going to deal with is looking at gravitational effects. That there is a modified theory of gravity. It's called Einstein-Cartan, where fermions actually, there are new fermion interactions that are attractive that have the same structure of BCS theory. These are theories that I played around with for a couple of years. And it's good to know that I discovered a friend yesterday, John, who has been doing work on these non-renormalizable theories. And I hope to learn some things from you. But these are non-renormalizable field theories, but I'll get into that in a second. And the idea is that in the early universe, okay, pre-inflation, inflation, usually around that time, this BCS, a condensate of fermions form. So we have this condensate. We have an effective potential for this condensate. And when you basically go through the Friedmann equation, you get dark energy behavior. But the thing that is interesting is when the neutrinos propagate in its own condensate, in its own medium. Okay, so there's a medium that neutrinos condense. A neutrino can be dissociated as a propagating state in this condensate, and it's like it's swimming like a submarine in its own fluid. And when it does this, it naturally experiences oscillation, right, with a rate that is proportional to the density of the neutrino. That's a basic idea. It's a simple idea. The Beatles would have loved it. And this is BS. I have no idea how to do that. I should take that out, maybe. Yes. Yes, I'm going to show you the next slide where you will see that theory. But before I do that, let me say a few things about BCS, the fundamentals of BCS theory, why it's so ubiquitous. Okay, it's ubiquitous physics because the minute I have a finite number density of fermions, the wave function organizes itself, the many-body wave function, or the field, you can do this also in field theory, organizes itself in momentum space. So when you look at the phase space of these many fermions, it organizes itself into a dispersion relation between the energy, so this is a surface of constant energy, a shell of in three dimensions, okay, and its momentum. And when I occupy all my states because of the exclusion principle, deep down in this from zero energy and zero momentum, all the way up to what we call the Fermi momentum, okay, there's a thin shell up here, which corresponds to available states that these electrons can propagate through, which we call that the conduction band. Okay, so this is an insulating band, and we have a band up here that's a conduction band. And now if you look at the energy levels, you find a degeneracy in that system. Okay, so this is the statement of BCF theory. So you have this wave function that's highly degenerate, and what you discover is actually this state is unstable when you turn on scattering of, and these are supposed to be an electron of an equal and opposite spin. And you find that the scattering induces correlations that yields an instability in that state, in the conduction band, to another state where the electrons pair up. Okay, so there's, in a sense, an expectation value that these electrons obtain in a new ground state, and that's a superconducting state. And BCS, of course, as we know, it took about 50 years to solve this problem. There was an ingenuity that had to go in, which is this idea that electrons could Cooper pair, they can pair up into a spin zero condensate, okay, and that the spin zero condensate is a quasi-particle. You can have an excitation in the spectrum now of creating pairs of electrons. And what that does is, basically, at the end of the day, you have a quantum mechanical system with a four fermion operator. It's a many-body system, and so it's very hard to diagonalize this wave from this Hamiltonian. The diagonalization corresponds to pairing up these electrons, creating operators that will diagonalize wave function. So the basic upshot is that in 1967, Nambu, Jonah, and how do you pronounce his name? Jonah Licinio, Italian physicist. Giovanni Jonah Licinio. So he made a relativistic version of BCS theory. So it wrote this theory down with in a Lagrangian formulation to explain chiral symmetry breaking, which I'll talk about in a second. So basically, it boils down to having, where is it? I'll get to that in a second. Four fermion interactions that are covariant. Okay. So where would you get such a thing? Well, first of all, the standard model doesn't have this. Because if you look at the Fermi interaction, G Fermi, that is induced by the W boson, okay, you have this current interaction, for example. If these were neutrinos, you find that they are in a repulsive channel. So I forgot to tell you that another ingredient in BCS is that you need to have a weak attraction between these electrons. That comes about because of screening. The phonon vibration will screen the electric charge. So it basically amounts to having some minus sign in front of here, but the weak interaction always gives you repulsive four fermion interaction. So it doesn't work in a standard model. So you need to get it from something else. So there's a long discussion. A lot of people in the canonical quantum gravity community are very familiar with this, what we call the Hulse action. So you write down general relativity in first order variables. You have your spin connection and your metric. What happens is that you can get back what I call the Christoffel symbol, okay, and an anti-symmetric part of this connection by solving what we call the metric compatibility condition. When you solve this condition, okay, you can get back, you can basically solve for W as a function of E or gamma as a function of G, depending on if you like Christoffel symbols. But when in the presence of fermions, this is not the case. If I couple fermions to gravity, notice there's an E here, right? There's an inverse triad, or tetrad here. So when I vary with respect to E, okay, I get an equation that ties in D with the fermion current now. D becomes D of this, right, which comes from varying this thing, I'm sorry, with respect to W, okay? I get D of E is no longer equal to zero, which was if I only had this term here, but I get D of E is proportional to the fermion current, okay? So in order to actually go back and get back my ordinary Einstein-Hilbert action, what I do is I say there's a part that's completely symmetric, so this anti-symmetric derivative vanishes on this thing, and so this is just actually this, okay, which is what we call a torsion tensor, is now equal to psi bar psi gamma mu. Since this term has no kinetic term, there's no kinetic term for torsion in this theory, I can plug it back in, and I will end up now with this, that's just a solution, I will end up with a fermion, a four-fermion interaction. Okay? And notice that there's this parameter here. This is called the Barbera-Imirtzi parameter. And that thing could either be positive or negative. So I have a choice, okay, of whether or not this can be a repulsive or an attractive interaction. The choice is mine. It's a free parameter. I'm allowed to use it. It actually means something, but I don't want to get into that now. So this is where I'm going to get my four-fermion interaction, okay? So what we can do once we have this four-fermion interaction, yeah.
So is this really the only place where this Imirtzi parameter can be classically tested, or?
No. There are two places it shows up, okay? And Simone Mercuri showed that actually they originate both from the same place. So if you, just so that for once and for all, what I really have to do is write Einstein-Hilbert plus a dual, and there is some function of this gamma here, okay, of R. This is a dual in the internal index. Okay, so there are two E's here. All right, and the dual is on these E's with respect to the internal index. So this Imirtzi parameter is here, but it's also in the four-fermion interaction, okay, what I have up here. Okay. And so why it shows up both in the gravitational and the fermionic degrees of freedom actually has it's a very deep thing have to
but
do with.
But isn't that second term just the topological term?
It's topological, yes.
So it doesn't really have any impact.
That's why I didn't write it down.
But so recently then there was a paper that said about the perturbation of the gravitational field in yesterday's variables. You see there's a relation between the gravities. We have some gravities which have a component, I mean, here dependence on gamma.
Yeah. But that's if you, there are some issues with that, but we can.
So what is that?
Gravitational waves will know about the difference between left hand and right hand.
Is it like Joao's?
Yeah, this is something that Joao did. It's related to what happens when you did turn Simon's graph.
But that's not classical. Yeah, so yeah. I guess my question is, can I just arbitrarily do that gamma thing to be very bad, whatever I want?
You could. Laurent and Dorje Minnick wrote a paper where they found that this thing has no constraints in particle physics.
So by torsion, you mean a tensor so that this is no longer letting the chip of the connection. Is that right?
So the way to think about this now is that I have gravity written purely in terms of Lebesgue to tensor, plus this extra piece, which I call torsion.
This is not the usual covariant derivative notion.
So this theory that we have here is now pure Einstein-Hilbert, where I've basically put all the torsion pieces in this four-fermion interaction. That was the procedure that I tried to do there. So once you include the four-fermion interaction, then you have pure Einstein-Hilbert with all the good stuff that you like, plus, but now you have to include this term. Otherwise, you have not solved the metric compatibility condition. Okay. So how do you get the modern way of, there's a beautiful paper by Bjorken called Emergent Gauge Boson, where he nicely spells out the modern technique for getting the condensate. And what you basically do is you include, okay, your fermionic, you know, effective action plus a tree-level term that completes the square. Because, you know, if you functional integrate over Grassmannian fields, the minute you can put it in a Gaussian way, you can completely integrate this, perform a functional integration. It's a standard technique now. And once you do this, you get an effective action for the condensate. So what I'm saying here is you're integrating subject to delta is equal to psi bar psi. Okay? And these are the vial fermions. I've just decomposed my fermions into vial fermions, left and right-handed ones. And what you find is that you get an effective potential, or an energy density in this case, which corresponds to the minimum of this potential, okay, plus a chemical potential. So in this case, we need fermions or neutrinos to be filling the universe. Where they come from, I have no idea. I'm assuming that. Okay. And so we end up with this interesting non-analytic potential. And we can go about and solve, we end up with transcendental equation because these deltas are also functions of A. I miss a whole bunch of steps. There's a paper with Carl Cagney, myself, and Tirto Biswas, where we actually carefully did the effective field theory here. And the important thing that a lot of people miss is that when you quantize the fermion fields, you have to quantize it with the scale factor. So when you actually do all this gap equation, all these calculations, the scale factor gets hidden up here. And delta also becomes a function of A. So you end up with a transcendental equation when you solve the Friedman equation. So we went ahead and numerically solved it because, okay. And something interesting happened. When delta is tiny, like milli-electron volt scale, okay, you can get a solution to this transcendental equation.
Yeah,
so in this sense, delta is behaving like a time-dependent vacuum energy.
But I mean, there is no such thing as time-dependent vacuum energy.
Well, delta behaves like an auxiliary field, okay, that is time-dependent through the fermionic time dependence. Because delta is just a condensate of these fermions. So microscopically, because the fermions have time dependence, it shows up in delta, not through the time dependence of delta, but through the time dependence of the fermions. And that was taken into account.
Okay, so you're saying basically you are always near equilibrium of some sort.
That's right, that's right. That's actually the mean field approximation. And it's a very good question. A way to understand it is to see perturbatively how this thing happens. You're summing all the one loop diagrams of these fermions. And you know, these fermions have time dependent at all these loops, but when you resum them, you still have the time dependence, but it's now hidden in the time dependence of delta. So that's, but let me also say that needs to be, that's something that actually does need to be, you know, really looked at.
But, okay, so then I cannot actually vary the action for delta and find the evolution for delta, or can I?
You could.
Are you saying it's always sits at this minimum or something?
That's right, so you can vary this, that's a good point. You vary this action with respect to delta, you get an equation for delta, and it's actually an algebraic equation, though. And if you minimize it, it becomes a gap equation, literally the one that you see, you know, where the mass of the condensate is an exponential. Okay, this is the way to see it. But you don't have to minimize it. You could actually keep it and study its evolution. You don't have to minimize it. And in our case, we didn't minimize it. We kept it general. That's important, though.
But it seems to me, I'm trying to use my intuition about investigating scalar field effective actions, and usually two possibilities. If your scalar field is either sits at its minimum or is it slowly rolling down its potential. So if it sits at its minimum, I don't care about the kinetic term is because it just sits at its minimum, not the potential. If it's rolling down the potential, I need to know what the kinetic term is to actually.
I agree with that, and I think one thing that could be done very easily is we know that one loop effects will induce a kinetic term. So we can put a kinetic term back in there and go back and do everything. Okay? That's something to do. And in fact, one can study stability that way. That's a good point.
I guess people are going to do that at some point.
Yeah, we should do it now that I'm here. I'm here till Friday, so we can do
omega
it.
Omega here is a function of the Leibniz parameter.
Omega is a function of the emergency parameter. Yes, it is. Good. And we'll find, yes, that's important. One thing you might want to worry about is, G Newton is tiny. G Newton is tiny. Why do I expect this thing to be relevant? Well, there's an emergency parameter here. It's a free parameter. So I can retune this thing so that this looks, like a sizable effect. But I'm free to do that because it's a sterile neutrino. There are no constraints on it. All right, so that's the point. So if I can now compute the barotropic index from the usual equation and go about and solve this numerically, it's actually, and what we find generically is it starts off very actually like one of these ugly, what do you call these super accelerate, this really ugly phantom matter. Was the advisor that wrote papers about this phantom menace?
Phantom menace.
Yeah,
yes.
Jesus. Okay. Well, thanks to him, I can get away with it. So basically what we see is that it basically, at late times, just asymptotes to a de Sitter attractor. Right? And that's a basic point. But the point that I want to now go back, since I didn't want to waste my time talking about the physics of neutrino oscillation, because now that you understand how it works, if you want to construct any model of neutrino oscillation, you know what to do. You write down, your usual Dirac equation for your neutrino. Here it is. These A's now become flavor index, neutrino 1, neutrino 2, neutrino 3. It's in its mass eigenbasis. Okay, so it's all diagonal. I sum of all A. And then I put in a mass term here. But my mass term is delta. Where did this delta come from? It came from the effective action that I integrated. So there's a delta. So it comes from exactly the self-consistently from the effective action that I computed. Okay, it's a tree-level interaction. So we got this delta. I don't want to lie to you. I assume that my condensate has flavor. What allows me to do that? Well, what allows me to do that is I've made an assumption, and this is the dangerous part that you might want to now attack me on, is that gravity knows about the weak interaction. Because whenever I rotate from a flavor eigenbasis to whatever, that is done through a weak rotation. It's just a different basis transformation on weak isospin, SU2 weak isospin. Okay? So I'm assuming here that somehow this gravity, my gravity theory, knows about the weak interaction, which was the reason why I was motivated to do all this weak gravity thing. That's where it's coming from. If that is the case, and I don't know if it's the case, but it's a horrendous assumption to make, but if it is the case, I have a condensate that is 10 to the minus 3 electron volts. I go and I just plug and chug. I get delta M plus this new stuff here. I went back and I rewrote the Dirac equation in the relativistic approximation that I showed you before. So I got my delta M over the 2E. Well, what is this delta M? Delta M is nothing more than the difference. I hope I put that here. Oh, I screwed up. Okay. Delta M is the difference between the two different condensates, say psi AB, okay, which is a condensate, is not equal to psi BA. If it is the case that the condensate, okay, for different flavors, I imagine myself being in a network, let's say, of a condensate made up of different flavors of neutrino. It's homogeneous and isotropic. It could be because it's in a flavor space, okay? And if it's different, because somehow gravity is violating the equivalence principle in the weak sector, that's what's really going on. This is nothing new. Gasparini and Veneziano spoke about this in the 80s, that neutrino oscillations could be maybe a remnant of the violation of the equivalence principle rather than adding masses to neutrinos in the standard model. If I do that, then I don't have to introduce masses in the standard model. It's because the neutrinos are coupling to this condensate that's flavored. That's a new shift. But if I do that, since the condensate is responsible for the late time acceleration, it shows up in the oscillation phase. So the same number, okay, for the dark energy turns out to be the same number for the oscillation. Makes sense. If you're in a submarine, you know, your velocity will depend on the density that you're moving in. That's probably a bad analogy. So how much time do I have? Am I? Okay. So I want to talk about another speculative idea. So let me say also that I did get, there was a time I scooped Adrian and Mark, but turns out he got revenge on me and he scooped me. So it turns out when you do this, you actually end up not only with ordinary violating oscillation, but you end up with CTP violating oscillation, which is this term, that you cannot escape. And so Mark and Arena and Ando scooped me, and they, you know, probably end up being the referee of the paper of my paper anyway. So, yes, yes, yes. Thank you. So delta AB, okay, I can write as a coupling matrix. It's a 3x3 matrix, and there'll be a delta EX, EE, delta EX everywhere else, which corresponds to a condensate, an electron flavor, and a lepton neutrino flavor. So the idea here is that,
We don't know what that number is.
We don't know what those numbers are. They're free parameters.
So this looks like the MSW mechanism for neutrinos in the sun, except for the...
It's exactly the MSW mechanism.
Exactly that. Okay.
Neutrinos, right, their flavor oscillations change when they move in the sun because there's an electron number density, right? So there's an interaction in the standard model that looks like electron-electron, right, gamma mu, electron, muon, neutrino, induced by a W minus trans interaction. And so in the sun, you have a number density of this, and this basically changes the oscillation rate. The number density in the sun changes the oscillation rate of a neutrino as it moves in the background, okay, of electrons. This is the MSW effect.
The background's the condensate.
It's a condensate. Now it's a condensate. Now neutrinos are moving in its own condensate. So it's literally the MSW effect for a neutrino condensate. All right. So that's the basic statement there. So in the last 10 minutes, I want to talk about some work that's being done right now with my postdoc, Antonino, who's sitting right there in the middle. No.
Can I ask
a question?
So a small question regarding... So what do we have to... Do we have to agree with the loop quantum gravity or?
No.
Just some effective.
This is just, good old fashioned general relativity with four fermions.
So there's.
You have to deal with questions that John is going to help me deal with, which is the field theory side of things, which I hid from you. Because
I thought you had the emergency parameter there.
Yeah, but the emergency parameter at the classical level has nothing to do with loop quantum gravity. It's just a free parameter that comes when I minimally couple fermions to gravity. Okay. Let me put it another way. If I write down the host action, which is this extra topological term, it does naturally give me the canonical variables of in loop quantum gravity. But in its own right, it's just a theory of gravity with fermions. It's basically Einstein quartan. Yeah. It's like adding a theta sector to general relativity.
Sorry.
Yeah.
If you write the Judas equation for the neutrinos in terms of the Luci-Tai connection, right? The right hand side is not zero. We have extra term.
Yeah.
How big is this term? I want to. My aim is that is it possible to, for instance, measure this by the something like
That's a good point. And I think the answer is that should be, one should do a perturbation analysis of this and see how it affects lensing. Well, we're claiming that if it is a dark energy density, then it's a lensing effect due to dark energy that might clump. I mean, so the question I ask you is if, you know, in models of dark energy that clump, okay, or where the equation of state changes rapidly, I mean, I'm sure there's work. I would like to understand how one looks at lensing for models of dark energy where the equation of state changes, say, very rapidly.
I think Oh. You had to tell us for that neutrinos.
Yeah.
Oh.
We are observing neutrinos, for instance. Then your geodesic equation is changing by the right hand. So you have an extra term at the right. Then
good. You should see some correlation between oscillation events from where you're looking and lensing.
So my question is that how big is this?
I don't know. I haven't. It's a good question. I mean, this is at. This work is at the zeroth order, and I hope that people work on it. So with the last couple of minutes, I just want to say a little bit about this type of model. And again, it's very similar. So the problem with the neutrino oscillation picture is that where am I getting my strong? I need to make this thing robust. You know, these neutrinos should be attractive. Is gravity really enough? How much tuning do I have to do? So we know of physics. We know. Can I get a few more extra minutes? Is that cool? Okay. We know of physics that does condensation that is robust, and it has to do with the vacuum of our world. 99% of the masses of hadrons and quarks come from this mechanism, not the Higgs. Okay. So let me first tell you. I'll tell you what that is in a second. You know already. Here's something very interesting. If I extend the standard model, so I have SU3, I add another SU3. This is sort of like dark photon things, but now I have dark quarks and dark gluons. You might say, well, why do I want to do such a thing? Then Petr Harjava, who was here, would tell you why, and that there should be this. But if you do this, and then, so that's the degree of freedom that you're adding. You're just adding another copy. You know, you can extend this by a symmetry argument, for example. You just add another copy, and it doesn't couple to the photon. Then you would have a Lagrangian, and of course you do cosmology, you put R here. You would have your gluons with color indices and dark quarks, and an interaction energy between the quarks and the quark current and the gluons. And we do classical physics, okay? And of course, it'll be a Lagrangian for something that I want to talk about. So we know that in the standard model, when I have three flavors, we have three flavors of quarks. When I have three flavors and the QCD Lagrangian is massless, there is a symmetry, okay, which is SU3 flavor, not color. I have left-handed couple quarks. And SU3 right-handed. But we know, because when you study the hadron spectrum in the standard model, hadron spectrum, when you look at the low energy spectrum of hadrons, you don't find parity doublets. You don't find hadrons of the same mass, okay, which have parity opposites of each other. You don't find it. So it means that this parity invariant vacuum for the hadrons is violated. The theory spontaneously breaks this. And this is what Nambu solved. Nambu found a mechanism in QCD itself, okay, that solved this, and it had to do with the pairing of a color neutral and an electrically neutral quark, up and a down bottom quark, and that's that dynamical mechanism that the gluons coup a pair, okay, up and down quark, and that's a pion. So our vacuum is really a vacuum condensate as we speak. Of these massless pions. These are the Nambu-Goldstone mode of the breaking of this symmetry into the SU3 that's chiral symmetry breaking. And look at the mathematics of this. This is a cheap version of Nambu-Goldstone, if I have two more minutes. I have my quark kinetic term with the gauge field with N flavors. Let's do with N flavors. And Nambu introduces four fermion term which he argues comes from hard gluon scattering, just like the weak scattering. And the trick is, again, use a modern approach. There's an old-fashioned approach, which is you replace, you do a self-consistent mean field theory. You replace this by some auxiliary field, pi, plug it into Lagrangian, and do a functional integration to get the effective action, which is exactly what I did for the thing. Okay? And when you do this, you get an effective action, which is your kinetic term of your pion and a potential. This is a rho meson. We'll ignore that for now because it's not the ground state. So we have an effective action for the pion and a relationship between the current of the pion and its and the pion field. This is a something called a decay constant. And now what I want to do in the last two slides is to show you that if I took this Lagrangian, assume that there was a chiral symmetry break-in at last scattering in, with this dark sector. So here's my gluon field. Okay, I assume a rotationally invariant state. Some funky physics of inflation set that up for me. I don't know. Okay, I'm just following my nose here. You plug this in, your kinetic term, you end up with a, so notice that you assume that that your gauge field is proportional to the scale factor times an unknown field that we'll solve for. I could rewrite that as phi. So we have a kinetic term with this really nonlinear term here, plus the interaction energy between the gluon and the current. That's my first Lagrangian. So I have two equations of motion, that for the condensate of the gauge field and the pion condensate. Notice that this pion couples via this J term here. So it's here. So you have a coupled differential equation. And we have the Friedmann equation to solve as well. And if you run through the mill, of course, you can calculate the equation state parameter. Let me give you the poor person's version of why you get late time acceleration. Okay? The poor person's version is that this is basically radiation with some nasty kinetic term, some nasty extra non-Abelian term. But imagine that at first this thing dominated, so it behaved like radiation. And this term was subdominant. But at some point, because it's redshifting like 1 over the 8 to the 4th, for example, at some point this term might dominate. Why might it dominate? It might dominate if this thing it scales as a scale factor, and this goes as 1 over the scale factor. Why? Well, you have to look at the field equations in a second. And notice this difference in a plus and minus sign. So if this term becomes subdominant at late times, I could have late time acceleration. And it turns out that there's a scaling solution, that when this current goes as 1 over a, it turns out that phi goes as a. And you can see that very easily when you neglect this term. When you neglect this term, if you study the equation for the gauge field, for example, it becomes this. And notice that when phi goes as a, this equation is solved. When h is constant, and that's exactly the Sitter expansion. Okay? And the interesting coincidence is that the initial value of the condensate is 10 to the minus 3 electron volts. Yeah?
So when is this transition between fading light radiation to fading light constant? When do you expect that to occur?
We have actually, we've plotted that. So let me skip this slide. This has to do with making the field equation self-consistent. But here's a plot of W in years. So, we don't see the line here. So Antonino worked very hard on Mathematica for weeks to render these things soluble. And here's the equation state parameter at last scattering, okay, in years. So this is roughly today. So the transition happens, I would say, around here, 10 to the minus 9 years. Okay, and we're somewhere here today. And that assumes that the gauge field is 1 electron volt, which means that the scale of QCD in the dark sector is 1 electron volt. If you do a renormalization group flow of the QCD coupling and you compare it to the visible QCD, it turns out that the scale of QCD differs from the dark one by 10 orders of magnitude. So it's not a horrendous hierarchy. A factor of 10. So it's not like some exponential hierarchy like the weak gravity hierarchy. So it means that there's some hidden symmetry between this dark sector and the visible sector that needs to be explored. That's what this is suggesting. So in other words, if the scale of this QCD, so I know how to do QCD, I know how to solve it exactly, in the ultraviolet, okay, above this scale, the minute I put my scale, I'm fine here. My effective field theory is well-defined in infrared, the effective field theory I'm using here. And it's interesting that the scale that gives you dark energy for the QCD theory is one, that's the only free parameter I have in QCD that I can, whose scale I fix. Once I fix that, I get a relation between this scale and the visible QCD scale.
Why is the accelerator expansion?
Good, excellent question. It ends because this term, it kind of bounces back into this term again. This term dominates at later time. And why, I don't know. I mean, I don't have an intuition for the nonlinear differential equations. It should be studied better.
So does the amount of time looking at around W minus 1 with the nonlinear
equation? Absolutely. It depends on the kinetic, how fast. So it's like a fast roll. It's a fast roll phase of acceleration rather than slow roll. Okay, that's a good, thanks for asking that question. I want to just end with work that we're doing now, which is dealing with these beasts. We have to do a perturbation analysis that Niyash is going to help us do, since he knows it much better than I do. But we have to look at the perturbation of the zeroth component, the longitudinal mode of the gauge field, and the spatial directions to make sure this thing doesn't blow up on us, okay? And also the condensate. And so far what we've found, okay, we're still thinking about the spatial component, but we found that these two pieces, the pion fluctuations and the gauge fluctuations, for sub-horizon modes are oscillatory. Obviously, they're tachyonic for super-horizon, but that's exactly why you get late-time acceleration. We are dealing with, and then we have to run it through Niyash's mill to see whether or not if the speed of sound for this thing is negative. All right, so that's kind of where things are at. And let me just conclude. Thanks for extending my time. And I hope you got something out of this. But the basic point I wanted to say is that I've motivated dark energy models with no cosmological constant from known physics, meaning condensates, okay, what we know about condensates, with minimal assumptions about where these degrees of freedom come from. In one case, there are neutrinos using this new physics, this physics, or in the other case, dark pions. Let me also add that we have colleagues now at the University of Chicago and Richard Hill and Bai, his student, I guess, and Raman Sundram, who are working now on models of dark pions as dark matter candidates. So these models have the possibility of connecting dark energy with neutrino oscillation. Again, it's a speculation, a possibility. More work needs to be done there. These assumptions about gravity, knowing about the weak interaction, is horrendous, but that's what one needs to do to get this effect. And there's more to understand with stability. In particular, these adiabaticity condition that Niyash destroyed the MAVEN models with, and also the details of the microphysics. We're dealing with non-renormalizable theories. We're dealing with strongly coupled physics. We're dealing with physics coupled to gravity, so we have to be very careful about the claims that we make. Thanks for having me. Yeah, what I mean is that, good. What I mean by that is, this is scary, okay? So we said that the torsion, okay, TmuIJ, okay, I could write as psi gamma mu psi. Let me put the IJ index out here. This comes, there are actually two tetrad fields sitting in front of here, okay? And then I said that these fermions condense, okay? So let's look at psi, a gamma zero piece. So I have an ether is my condensate. And then I went and I snuck in flavor indices in this. So I put AB. But that means that somehow this torsion, which is a gravitational degree of freedom, has this index. And when I want to go into the mass eigen, the flip, sorry, flavor eigenbase basis, I perform a unitary transformation. Okay, but this is SU2 rotation. This is a weak rotation. So this index actually is just a basis transformation in SU2 weak. So this torsion, according to this mechanism, knows about the weak interaction. What is a torsion? The torsion is this, the covariant derivative with respect to this Veerbaum field, right? Mu nu, okay? I, so this is Ti, mu nu, so this is the inverse of the torsion. So look at this torsion thing. The minute I put an index here, that means that the metric field is carrying a weak index. That's weird. But so far, you know, when I talk to my particle physics friends, it's very hard for them to worm their way out of saying that this is a wrong thing to do. Yes.
What about that if it has to be the Moon's principle? I mean, you would think that this is going to make things that are chosen weakly fall differently than things that are not chosen weakly, or flavor dependence in geodesics.
That's exactly the point. Now, the question is, good, and here's the interesting thing here. So here's how I worm my way out of that argument. Gravity is kind of, if I write gravity in terms of a left-handed connection and a right-handed connection, okay, and I say that the left-handed connection talks to everything in the standard model, and the right-handed connection talks to sterile neutrinos, then what I have is a violation of the weak equivalence principle for the sterile neutrinos. And the reason why now neutrinos oscillate is because the different mass eigenstates fall at different rates, rather than they have different masses.
But you're saying you don't expect to see any violations of equivalence principle in kind of neutrino sectors.
It might be the case because it could leak into those sectors. I mean, one has to do an analysis of that. And I'm basically avoiding answering your question because I simply don't know. I think it's something that one writes down the field equations and see whether or not that mix and leaks in of the equivalence principle.
I mean, I don't see why this would be stronger than the ordinary neutrino background. There is a cosmic neutrino background, so every particle that has weak interactions should couple to that. And so presumably it's not very weak that we don't see it, but given is there a reason for your model to be much more strong, your ether to be much more strongly attracting than the standard cosmic neutrino?
No. Because remember, the scale, this is merely electron volts.
Right.
So you have to look at violations at that scale. And I don't know what's known about that. It's a good question. I told you it was crazy.